Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Fran McCall, commodity specialist with Kentucky Farm Bureau. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
How's David and Vicki today?
Doing well. I'm doing okay. David's fighting. He's on the upward part, but he's
fighting a little bit of sickness, but we'll get through it. It'll all be all right. I've got my plethora of cough drops that I did not buy in Dixon, Kentucky.
Because you can't find them in Dixon, Kentucky.
So we're in good shape. We're going to roll right through with Fran here.
Running joke there.
Yeah.
There are some things you can find in Dixon.
We're
told that the best ag agent in the state lives
well,
there.
Well, I have been told that many times by Sharon Spencer and from the Kentucky Department of Agriculture. I've been told that on more than one occasion. So.
Well, she knows what she's talking about most of the time.
So they say. I'm not sure if that's exactly right, but we'll move on.
I think that was more of a declaration than a vote, per se. So.
That's true.
Got a guest with us today, Ms. Fran McCall. How are you this
good
morning?
Thank you for having me. Look forward to visiting with you all.
Glad to have you. Former co-worker. You were
yes,
an extension agent
I was.
At one point
Almost
in life.
3 years was my first job out of grad school and over in McLean County down in David's area.
That's right.
4-H agent, stretch out of college. It was a good experience for me.
I couldn't remember how long you were there. David and I was talking about that on the way up, that you were in McLean County, but I could remember when you came and I remember when you left, but I just didn't remember how many years you were there.
Just before State Fair in August of 2009 and left in April of 12. So
okay,
she's there 3 or 4 years then. So she was there a little bit. She knows the landscape.
I do.
Down in our part of the country. She's not from that part of the country, but she knows the landscape.
Beautiful
down there.
Area. A lot of agriculture.
Where is home for you?
I grew up in Oldham County, but I currently live in Shelby County with my husband and my three boys. So, we're very blessed.
Yes. Yep,
absolutely.
Yes. Well, tell us a little bit about your agricultural experience, kind of what brought you into the agriculture world and how you got to where you are.
Great. Yeah, I grew up in a diversified operation in Oldham County. My parents managed it for 25 years. They're in Prospect. Their main interest was horses, but my dad took care of the hay and the crops. We raised some grain, and then we had about 120 head of cattle, purebred Shorthorns, did a lot of marketing. We had production sales, sold cattle all over the country. Participated in a lot of sales and shows and did that. Grew up in 4-H and FFA. I have a younger brother, and we would go to almost 30 shows a year showing our cattle. Was really big in Shorthorns on the national, state, and local level. And livestock judging was one of my passions growing up in 4-H. I was on the gold team in 2001, competed on behalf of Kentucky 4-H, and then went on to do the FFA contest as well my senior year, and was second overall team and then high individual that year. And then went on to college at Western Kentucky University and got a degree in agriculture with emphasis in animal science, and still wanted to learn a lot more, and the opportunity to coach the UK judging team came about. Mm-hmm. And so I went to UK and did my master's in both ruminant nutrition and meat science, and had a great opportunity there to coach two teams at UK and travel the country with a wide variety of youth that now a lot of them are agents as well, the Meyer clan and Shelley and Shannon Wade, and now they're both married, and Kevin Farrell, one of their husbands, and then Michelle Ogden. She's now a elementary education teacher, but she was a natural resources coordinator for a while and still involved in her family farm, but had a lot of opportunities to travel, get to know people across the country. And then when looking for a career after my master's at UK, stumbled across Extension, which is no stranger to me, and was a 4-H agent for almost 3 years, like I said earlier, in McLean County. And then an opportunity to come back home. And I just gotten married, and my husband and I got to move back home and be close to both of our families. They're both in Henry and Oldham counties. And so he could come back and farm with his family. And that's where we've been. And I've been here at Farm Bureau for 12 years now. But at home, we have we farm about 1,200 acres of row crops, both corn and soybeans. We have about 80 head of cattle. We have about 25 purebred cattle, shorthorns, and red polls. And then we have commercial herd as well. And we raise all of our own hay, about 150 acres. And like I said earlier, we have three boys, so they keep us busy.
Yeah.
My oldest is 9 now, and so he's now officially a 4-H'er. So we've got that new chapter in our life, and so we're really excited. And it's my family was always involved in agriculture, my great grandparents, and you know, we've always been had cattle or crops or something, and so it's my second nature. So I'm blessed to work with the farmers across Kentucky each and every day with my job here at Farm Bureau.
Absolutely.
When you grow up in agriculture, it's just you can't hardly go away from it, really. Even and you know, there's some that think, man, when I get out, When I graduate college, I'm going as far away from the farm as I can. But most of the time, that doesn't happen. They'll just turn right around and stay there on the farm, because it's just a way of life that you just, it's just in you.
That's right. And I've known Fran and Wes for a long time. My kids grew up showing pigs when they were showing cattle. And so I've been around them and their family for many years, good folks and good agriculture folks.
Right.
You know, we have a lot of those in a certain segment of our, you know, our industry, those good agriculture folks. And I certainly would think that they are some of them. And Fran, tell us a little bit about, I know your son is big into rabbit showing.
Yep.
And so tell us a little bit about what got y'all involved in that. And I mean, this show is not all about agriculture. We like to dive into we like to dive into some different things that our guests do. So tell us a little bit about that, about how you show a rabbit and what they look for and all that kind of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. So I actually had rabbits in 4-H. Not a lot of people knew that. I got them about, like, I think I was like 13. And so I had them until I went to college, and Wes decided he didn't want to clean the cages anymore, so he dispersed my rabbits. And then when my husband and I got married again, we were like, oh, we needed something like a hobby, because like our cattle, people think of it as a hobby, but it's not really, it's our business, so we try to make a little money on that operation too. But our rabbits, we call that our hobby. And you know, going to a rabbit show is a whole lot easier than packing the trailer and load it up. So you put your lawn chairs and the rabbit cages in the car, and you take a little snack and a cooler, and off you go in the SUV. So rabbits are pretty easy, but we show mini rex rabbits. There's a lot of different kinds of breeds of rabbits, but mini rex are about 4 to 4.5 pounds. They're known for their fur. They're very soft. They have that very rexy type feel. They're a smaller breed of the rex breed, which are like 10 to 12 pounds. These are the smaller version, and they've been around for about 40 years. This variety. There's over 26 different colors of mini rex, and so we have about 7 different colors. Currently, my son is number one in chocolates and what we call a smoke pearl, which is like kind of a gray and white mix color in the country, and points. So he's accumulated enough points across the country. So we're hoping that still stands for that he'll be the top youth mini rex breeder in 2023. So we'll find out that in our spring show in April. But to go back to your question about showing the mini rex rabbits, we pose them on the table. So we put them on the table and we push them together and we look at their conformation. They're supposed to be like a little ball on the table. So they're judged pretty much 50% on their fur and then 50% on their conformation. So they're kind of like a little show steer, David, if that makes sense. You want them short, compact, really full, and then you look at their density of their fur, the color of their fur, how it feels going forward and backwards, and then each color has, you know, a certain nail color that they have to have. Their eyes are supposed to be a certain color. They have to be healthy looking. They look at their toes, make sure they have rabbits have five toenails on their front and four on their back, so they have to make sure that they have them, that they haven't broke one, or there's they look at their teeth to make sure that their teeth are correct, and make sure there's no abnormalities. And it's a lot of, you know, things that they look at. And to be a rabbit judge, you actually have to go be certified. And there's over 100 recognized breeds of rabbits in the United States. And so, you know, it's several years that, that these people do training to, you know, be a judge. They have to take a written test, and then they have to practice under you know, kind of like an apprenticeship with a person that is already a certified judge. And it's a long process. And so we're judged on a standard. You know, in livestock judging, you know, it's more of a, your opinion. You're judging kind of on your own. But on rabbits, you actually are judged on a standard. So there's a standard perfection book that has all the breeds and all the different colors and how, you know, you look at that. And, you know, that's how they're judged. And so we've been very successful with rabbits. We have about 80 in our garage right now.
Oh, my.
And so we try to breed them year-round because mini recs, you have to constantly have a turnover. It's not like you have the heifer that you show for 2 years. The rabbits, you know, they're showed 6 months or under and 6 months and up. But the fur, you can only keep their fur so well for up to about a year plus, and then their fur kind of, you either need to breed them or move on.
Right.
So you constantly have to have those younger ones coming in to replace the older ones. Yeah. So yeah, it's our fun passion. We travel. Yeah. I think the furthest we've ever gone to a rabbit show was Texas, which people thought was crazy. But we went to the National Mini Rec Show down there. There was 1,200 rabbits. We had it with in conjunction with another couple other breeds. So there was like a couple thousand. This past October, the 100th American Rabbit Breeders Convention was actually here in Louisville at the fairgrounds, and there was 25,000 rabbits in the West Wing and the pavilion. And it actually will be back here in 2 years again. So keep that in mind that you might want to go see that. That would be a good opportunity.
I had never been around rabbits much, and we were buying some show pigs one time from a guy named Dave Walters, who's up in Indiana, up towards Fort Wayne, and he breed rabbits, and so we went to his house for something, I don't even know what we were, and he says, "Have y'all ever seen rabbits?" And I said, "Well, no." And he said, "Well, come on out here." And he had all these hanging cages in these buildings. It was really swanky. And so I was asked, I said, "Well, how do you show a rabbit?" And he said, "Here, let me set him up for you." And he gets out this little table, and he wads this rabbit up, is kind of the way I, and he just bunched him up. And I'm not kidding you, the loin on that rabbit was huge. I mean, it was 4 inches wide. It was huge. But it was pretty neat. He said, "Here, let me set him up for you." And so he got one of his good ones out, and I don't know what breed they were, but, I mean, they were really, it was pretty neat just to see that. So there's a whole different, you know, 4-H project right there for people that if you can't have livestock, this is a great way for kids to be involved in 4-H.
A smaller investment project, and you know, each rabbit's judged differently and shown differently too. There's some rabbits that are run up and down the table. Those are called English spots. Flemish giants are also judged that way. Some are posed with their head arched up high. There's some that are stretched out on the table. Those are called Himalayans. They're the only breed that's judged like that. And then there's some that are like a semi-arch, where ours we squish up into a little ball. These are kind of longer. Those are probably what you were talking about. Were they big rabbit?
Yes.
Yeah. So those meat rabbits.
Yes.
So yeah, those are very popular. The Florida whites, Californians are real popular for like meat pens, which some of our county fairs have those. Our county is actually looking to add that to our county fair, hopefully in the next couple of years. It just added meat chickens, so hopefully meat rabbits in the future.
So you mentioned all the different colors in. So is there a color that is preferred, or does that, the color doesn't matter as long as it matches
the standard.
Standards that set.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, there's a lot of people that have their own preference. Like, even in my own family, we have our own preference of rabbits. My favorite are the chocolates, which are, you know, like they sound, they're like a dark brown. My husband likes the lilac color, which is like a grayish color. We also have blacks. We have what we call broken, which is a white and then a mix of any of the other recognized colors. Those are very popular. They typically have some of the best fur. So you'll see a lot of those win a lot of the national shows. So we have probably 15 brokens because we like to have variety. As we're not just selling seed stock rabbits, we're also selling rabbits for pets. And so, you know, we need to have a variety of colors to meet our demand for our customers, as well as have some to different to show.
So. Do they breed true? I mean, like the chocolate, when you breed two chocolate rabbits together, that's what I was going to ask you.
No, you know, I think my shorthorn breeding is complicated. You know, when I breed two roans, you know, I could have a white, I could have a roan, I could have a solid red. No, these rabbit things crazy. Like, we'll breed two chocolates together, and we've gotten whites before, we've gotten lilacs, which the lilacs are recessive of the chocolate and the black, so that one makes more sense. But we've also these, so ours are broken down to groups. So we have the selfs, which are black, blue, lilacs, chocolates, whites, are all selfs. And then we have the shaded, which are the tortoise, smoke pearls, shadeds. And so those are even more complicated when you breed them.
Yeah.
And my son loves these smoke pearls. Well, trying to get smoke pearl babies has been a challenge the last 2 years. Yeah. So we keep buying more smoke pearls to try to make more smoke pearls. So it's, and you know, that whole thing, multiply like rabbits, it's 30 day gestation. So you know, you can turn around and have a lot more rabbits quickly if you're not careful. Yes. So
give you Punnett Square a workout.
Yes. It's a little more complicated than just the Punnett Square, but it's a lot of genetics there in the rabbit breeding.
Yeah. So. Well, that's a great project for kids that,
absolutely.
You know, and if we've got some county fairs out there that don't have that, you know, maybe they may be something you want to add, or a 4-H agent that's listening that would like to have a 4-H program for kids that may not have the room to have those livestock, have cows or pigs or sheep or goats or something like this. This is a great project for those kids to learn.
Yeah, sure.
You still got the same things going on that you have to learn. You know, you have to learn hard work. You have to learn, you know, you got to keep things clean. You got to, you know, got to feed them and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So a great project for kids that, you know, may not have the opportunity to raise livestock otherwise.
It's one of our fastest growing clubs in our county, actually. Yep. Our rabbit and poultry club, we share a leader. Yep.
I would think that would continue to grow too, because we see a lot more kids in FFA and 4-H that aren't necessarily from a farm.
Yep.
They may have an aunt or an uncle or an aunt or a cousin or something that may farm, but they're not directly from the farm and not grown up on the farm and the farming industry. And so I would think that this would continue to grow because, like you said, David, that this is a way for these 4-H'ers and FFA folks to still be involved in livestock showing, even if they can't show cattle or they can't show pigs or goats or sheep or whatever. But it be just as challenging, just as the competitive nature of it, and then just everything that goes along with livestock showing. You still have that, all of that to go with it. I think it's great.
The Kentucky Rabbit Breeders Association is a good resource. They sponsor a lot of shows and things across the country, so I'd encourage you to go on their Facebook page or their website if you're looking for more information.
I would guess most of these different breeds that you're talking about probably have their own websites as well that ties into.
Yeah, American Rabbit Breeders Association would be a good resource, and then you could get links from there to the other breed associations, and lots of information, educational resources. There's also cooking recipes with rabbits, health and disease questions, also a show portal, like where you can find all the shows across the country, because we go to Indiana and Ohio a lot to show as well as Kentucky, because it only has so many shows here. So that's a good resource as well.
Well, that's fantastic, Fran. I did not know that it was this involved.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, but obviously, with it doesn't, I don't guess it, matters the livestock that you're involved in. It's all have. But tell us a little bit about your purebred operation with your shorthorns and kind of what, from an early age, you know, I know your mom and dad had shorthorns. Why shorthorns? Why was that picked?
Yeah, so my family has had shorthorns since 1892. I'm a fifth generation shorthorn breeder. My kids are six. I was the national shorthorn queen in 2005, 2006. But it's been a family tradition, family business. My great-great-grandparents came over from Germany in the late 1800s and settled in Iowa, and they started off with shorthorns. And so my dad's side of the family is where that rich history comes from it. But you know, my grandmother still talks about farming with her grandfather and raising shorthorns and consigning shorthorns to many sales in Iowa. They always talked about going to the Iowa State Fair, and that was a mm-hmm. rich history in the Midwest. And then my mom, when she started in 4-H, her dad was looking for a good breed for her to fit in, and so she bought some shorthorns from several breeders in Illinois, which mm-hmm. Iowa and Illinois are very popular with shorthorns. And then when she was older, in her late teenage years, she actually bought a heifer from a guy that my dad was working for. And the deal was, if she bought this heifer, they had to take her to the shows that summer and fall. Mm-hmm. And so that's how my mom and dad met back in the late 70s. And then they got engaged, and in 1980, they had three different opportunities for farm managing jobs. One was Kentucky, and they came here in March, and the grass was green, and it was warm, and there was no snow, and so Kentucky sold them in 1980, and they've been here ever since.
Yep.
But my brother and I, you know nothing else. I mean, shorthorns mm-hmm. have been in our history and our blood, and my brother farms with my mom and dad and mm-hmm. manages about 75 shorthorns there in Henry County. And then my husband got started in shorthorns when he joined our 4-H beef club in the 90s, and so we've been involved very much in the Shorthorn Association. Mm-hmm. He's currently the president of our state association. I'm the secretary, my dad's the treasurer, so you know, if we have to have a board meeting, we can have it over a family dinner sometimes.
Yeah, that's right.
But my dad was on the National American Shorthorn Board back in the 80s when I was little, and my mom's been the national president of the Shorthorn Lassies back in the day. I served on the board several years ago, and so we've all taken our turns to give back to the breed that we mm-hmm. love. And we travel to the annual Junior Nationals every summer. My son just started doing that. This is his third one that he went to this past year, and so it's a family reunion. Yeah. Just like, you know, we were talking about agriculture just being one family, our Shorthorn breed is a big family reunion. Mm-hmm. Over the New Year's, I had a friend of mine that I met through Shorthorns from California was here at my house visiting. Some of my best friends have Shorthorns across mm-hmm. the country. So, yeah, it's just what I know.
You know, and it's a great way for youth, and I always say this, all livestock projects are great for youth to meet other youth mm-hmm. that have similar interests. And you said it, you know, I've got friends from California mm-hmm. that came to my house, and I've got, you know, friends that, you know, all over the country that are involved in the same thing that I'm very interested
right.
in. So it's a great way, 4-H and FFA, a great introduction to that, but, you know, getting into these breed associations and things like that, mm-hmm. that people that have similar interests, it's a great way for youth to get out there and meet other people. And to hone their skills, because a lot of the skills that we learn through showing cattle or showing livestock will translate into everyday life anymore.
It does, and it opens up the doors and opportunities for things as you move along. Even when you get out of, you graduate high school and you're not in FFA anymore and you're not in 4-H, but those connections and that you made during that time oftentimes will open up doors further down as you start your career, and
exactly.
and then just building your network around you in your career. Those, a lot of times that's where it starts, way back you know, when you are in that high school mm-hmm. middle school age of making those connections.
So. A mentor of mine gave me a good piece of advice a long time ago. Sometimes it's not what you know, but it's who you know. Yep. And you cannot network enough. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I really emphasized to my students when I was back at UK in grad school and I taught undergrad classes, to get out and out of your comfort zone. Don't be afraid to, you know, go meet somebody new.
That's right.
'Cause they'll open a lot of doors. It got me a lot of places, and sure, still is taking me a long way.
And career. And that doesn't stop.
No,
that never stops. You're always continuing to network, and you're always continuing to make connections with people.
Yep.
Because you never know when you're going to need their help, or they're going to need yours, or you may have a question and you're like, I know how I can ask about that, you know. Yeah. And that's important. That's important in any career that you're in.
Oh, absolutely.
It's important to make those connections.
Absolutely. Well, Fran, I know we're not here to talk about all 4-H stuff and projects and
okay.
showing cattle, but we chase a rabbit every once in a while.
Hey, that's
so,
okay.
So what is your position here at Farm Bureau, and what are some of the things that you do?
Yeah, so my official title is Commodity Specialist, which means a wide variety of things. One of the most things that I'm proud of is I serve on the 4-H Foundation Board on behalf of Kentucky Farm Bureau, but I also serve as the liaison between Kentucky Farm Bureau and a lot of the commodity groups, specifically the fruit and vegetable folks, the direct marketing folks, and also the equine industry as well. A little bit with the livestock folks, but that's most of our other staff. Mm-hmm. But my primary role and the main thing that I do here at Farm Bureau is I work with the Certified Farm Market Program, and I've been doing that for over 9 years now. It's a very diverse program, and it's for folks that are direct marketing off their farm directly to the consumer. So we have anything from folks that have greenhouses to produce, to seasonal markets, pumpkin patches in the fall, for example, to year-round markets, markets that have bakeries and cafes and, mm-hmm. you know, are selling that year-round product directly to the consumer. And so we have almost 150 market members from all over the state of Kentucky and growing every year. And it's just a very exciting time to be in direct marketing in Kentucky.
Well, I think, you know, COVID probably brought a lot of this to the forefront, mm-hmm. don't you think? Mm-hmm. I mean, saw an increase from before COVID till now of the number of people that are involved in direct marketing.
Yeah, we had just over 100 market members prior to COVID, and we had a lot of growth that year of people, you know, that were looking for meat or looking for something to do at home. Maybe we went back to gardening that they had never done that before, and then they decided that wasn't for them, so then they went back to find that local farmer. We've seen a lot of young people coming back to the farm that are starting new businesses, or, you know, maybe mom and dad are into the row cropping and they were looking for their own niche there on the farm. So they put in a greenhouse, or they put out some produce, or they expanded to their family garden because they found enjoyment in that. And a lot of people that are doing a lot of value-added products as well, you know, making the jams and jellies, or the bread and butter pickles, or looking at bakeries or home-based processing has become very important. But I would say the biggest growth that we've seen in the last 5 years is our direct meat marketers. I get calls about that all the time. And especially with our emphasis on expanding meat processing in Kentucky with our ag development dollars, we've seen a big increase with that, and a lot of more opportunities for folks.
You know, we've had Greg Renfro on a couple of times, if I'm not mistaken.
We have.
He talked about it every time, about, you know, direct marketing and what the increase has been. And, you know, Fran, what are some of the advantages that you see for folks that are doing that direct marketing, being involved in Farm Bureau and trying to get the word out about their product?
Well, two main things, David, I would say, is networking with other folks that are doing similar things, learning from each other. We have several opportunities throughout the year of educational opportunities where they can come together. But then also having that, cutting out the middleman and taking out, you know, trying to sell, you know, for example, at my farm, you know, instead of selling all my calves at weaning or you know, after backgrounding them or something, you know, keeping them on feed and then selling directly to Vicky as, you know, a quarter or a half or, you know, maybe a, you know, a package of how many pounds of hamburger and a couple of steaks. Taking out that middleman has really helped our customers and our consumers find that relationship with the farmer, but also help our farmer to keep more of the profit in his pocket.
You know, we talked a couple of, on the way up here, Vicky and I talked a little bit about the educational opportunities that Farm Bureau provides for our producers. And what are some of those things that, that you know, that those educational opportunities?
We have several of them. We have a young farmer program, so they have young farmer leadership conferences both in the summer and the winter. We have our new Generation Bridge program that's for our 35 plus to 50 age bracket, so they have conferences as well. And then specifically with our Certified Farm Market program, we have an annual education meeting where we bring in outside speakers to talk about various things, whether it's marketing or social media or how to lay out your store, you know, those specific topics. You know, we also have some regional events where we go and visit one of our current market members. We see what they're doing, do an individual tour, and then we do some roundtable discussion. This past year, we've done some discussion on websites, refreshing that. You know, everyone talks about Facebook. Well, you've got how do you keep up with the times with that? You know, how do you keep your followers and how they change the algorithm? A lot of that things. And then also that opportunity I was talking about earlier, the networking, learning from each other. You know, we have wide variety of knowledge level and generational differences and young people and old people and looking for new avenues. So Farm Bureau gives those members opportunities for that as well, David, on, you know, different levels. And then we also have our magazine and our website and all those other avenues as well that you're probably more familiar with.
Well, I think it, too, on the networking part, I think it's really good because your younger folks that are coming into the business, they can be mentored by some of these folks that have been in this in the business for what they're doing, whether it be a greenhouse production or whether it be an orchard or it doesn't really matter what the commodity is, but they can really connect with these folks and really be mentored. Those learn from those on a one-on-one type thing because – and they may meet at these educational opportunities that you all have, whether it's the regional ones or the annual conference that you have, or some of the tours that you do, where they're, these folks are on these tours all together and they're networking on that bus. I was fortunate enough to be able to go on two of them on this for the certified farm market tours. But you know, it's really neat to be able to watch them talking and networking about, well, you know, I tried this on the farm and you know, this worked really well or it didn't work really well, or just being able to learn from each other, and especially the young folks talking to the more experienced folks. And I've seen that multiple times where they take that opportunity, and I think that's great.
Yeah, our tours are a great opportunity for folks. So we've been doing those over 15 years now. They started as an in-state tour where we just go around to visit other markets. But now we expanded over 10 years ago now out of state. This past year, we went to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. This coming year, we're going to go to Texas and the Houston and San Antonio area, see a wide variety of opportunities down there, some meat marketing as well, like we were talking about earlier, but also greenhouses and produce, just a little different climate down there, and they can grow a little different things. One thing we're going to go see is a pecan grove. There's a lot of olive production down in Texas, and so big nursery producers down there as well. So that gives our members opportunities to see things outside of the state. But back to what you were saying about the networking, Vicky, I can think of a couple of years ago, I had one of my cider operators, one of my orchard growers, he was trying to talk one of my other orchard growers how to fix his cider mill over the phone. Well, they couldn't get it quite to do, so when his store closed that night, he drove to the other farm and helped him fix his market, you know, his cider, so he could continue to press cider. That, and that's what farmers do. They pitch in and help each other, and, you know, that couple years ago, there was a fungus issue in one of my greenhouses, and my greenhouse folks worked together to help each other out and come up with a solution. And that's what happens when you make those connections, and whether it's with Farm Bureau or the Fruit and Vegetable Conference that we have annually here in Kentucky, those are opportunities for our producers out there to work together.
One of the things that I noticed on the two tours that I've been able to go to, even though where you're going, the growing conditions are different, and so you may not be able to produce the things that they're producing, but you pick up ideas for your own farm. And I know that this year, a lot of it, when I was able to go on the one this past year, and when you go to a lot of those farms, as far as the agritourism part, they use those gravity flow wagons and made them, it's basketballs, that was big there, and everybody there that had an agritourism in Kentucky that was there was taking pictures, they was measuring, they was doing everything for ideas, because they was like, man, I could implement this on my farm. And the other thing was when you go into their stores and see just how they have things set up, just the displays, the marketing ideas that you pick up from going to these different places, even though you're not raising the same thing, you're not selling the same thing, but there's so much you can learn and bring back. Mm-hmm. And from my standpoint, I was able to share a lot of things with my farmers market folks that, you know, I was taking pictures and sending to folks and saying, hey, you might want to think about this. And so I think it's just another educational opportunity that you all offer for your members. And I think that, I mean, it's just, and it's something that maybe some folks still don't know about, you know. So hopefully.
You know, I think a lot of times we discount what networking can do for us. And you know, I've always said, even when we have a meeting, we have an extension meeting, a lot of the problems that are talked about that day are solved out in the hallway after the meeting or before the meeting or at the breaks. When you get those farmers together and they can talk to one another and they can figure things out, I think a lot of times we have those solutions that will come up. May not be exactly what we're talking about in the meeting, but it is a solution for those folks. And I think that's exactly what Farm Bureau provides, is that opportunity for those folks to get together, you know, and point them in the right direction and say, hey, we're going to take a tour, you know, of the farmers markets and of all those people are on the bus, they're going to naturally start talking about different problems that they have. And hopefully there's somebody there that has experienced that, especially if there's a younger person there, experienced that, and they can help them solve their problem. You know, I heard you talk a while ago about how they had the market laid out. Or, you know, and that type of thing. And if you're selling meat direct, you know, maybe it's the cut of meat that you're marketing. You know, maybe you need to have a different cut. Mm-hmm. It maybe need to be called something different.
Or labeling, how you have it
displayed. Labeling and
packaging.
That kind
of, all those things come into play when you're trying to market to the consumer. Mm-hmm. What looks most eye-appealing, eye-catching.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Absolutely.
Very important.
And that's a big part of direct market. When you're selling direct from the farm, that is huge. You have to be able to get their attention, and when they come in, it's got to be pleasing to the eye.
Yeah, and it's not like going to the grocery where you've got a selection of 15 different products. You know, you've just got what you've got, and so you need to be able to market that and label that in a way that's eye-appealing and pleasing to the consumer, and that's what we're trying to please. We're trying to please a consumer.
That's right.
And I think sometimes we forget that and go, well, this is the way I want to do it, and that's not the way the consumer wants it.
You know, I think our producers have faced more obstacles with their direct meat marketing just because of what you just said, David. And it goes back to the fact that part of it is a consumer education side of it. People need to know that a whole cow can't just be cut up into ribeyes. and that's been one of those challenges for the producers, is being able to market the rest of that produce, whether it's, for most of our beef people, it's ground beef. That's the obstacle, that's right. That just because the yield of ground beef is so much greater than everything else. So, good point.
Yeah.
I agree 100%.
Looking at different marketing opportunities too, whether, you know, it's a restaurant to sell the ground beef to, or maybe the roast, and how they market, a lot of Mar Market members see the bundles where they have to have a roast or two roasts, and as well as, you know, 5 to 10 pounds of hamburger, and then they can get so many steaks. So those opportunities are available, but yeah, just like you're talking about, getting rid of those other cuts is a challenge sometimes.
Marketing is a job within
it
itself.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're going to do a good job at marketing, it is a job within itself for sure.
And answering all the questions too. A lot of people like to use Facebook Messenger and send questions, and you know, people don't respond right away. They get their panties in a wad. You know, you got to keep your customer happy, but you also have to draw the line there, consumer.
Yeah. And I think too, it's learning your customers and learning when to be available. Mm-hmm. To knowing when your hours of operation need to be, because you know a lot of folks are going to be coming after they get off work, and just learning, you know, when you need to be open, when you when you can be closed, what day of the week is the best day to be closed to prepare for the rest of the week, and all of those types of things. There's just a lot that goes into not just growing it. It's, it, you know, to get it out the door, there's a lot of
steps. Which is what we're
steps.
Good at. All farmers are good at growing stuff, but we're not very good at telling the story.
No, so it's all that other stuff that we're not so good at. And as far as the direct marketing with the folks that you work the most with, that is so key.
A lot of times people will come in or call me with lots of ideas and things, and I always recommend that they start with a business plan. And if they're not familiar with K-Card, I really introduce them to them and help them out, you know, to set themselves up for success instead of, you know, jumping in with both feet. A lot of people are like, well, yeah, I'm going to be open 5 days a week or 6 days a week. And I'm like, well, have you really seen that's when your customers are going to come? Are you just going to be sitting there twiddling your thumbs? Where, you know, you could be doing something else on a Monday when business is slow. So establishing that ahead of time. And then those are things that we try to push with our new members and also our older members, you know, to look at those opportunities, see what everyone else is doing. Don't copycat your neighbor, because that will not go well. But, you know, there's a lot of things out there, and we hope to provide the best opportunities for our members and help them with those kind of things down the road. So,
well, absolutely.
You know, Fran, before we get completely wrapped up, you have some responsibilities here at Farm Bureau related to Black Vulture permits as well. That's something that's becoming more and more of a problem every year, even though it seems like we don't hear about it quite as much as we used to. Talk just a little bit about that for our listeners.
Yeah, so Kentucky Farm Bureau offers a Black Vulture depredation permit, and so you can apply with our office. The application is on our website at kyfb.com, and then you look for the Black Vulture. You can download that and email it back to us or mail it in. You can get up to 3 takes, and you do not have to be a Kentucky Farm Bureau member to apply for that. So it's open to any producer in Kentucky. It does have to be for livestock. Sometimes we'll get inquiries, people that have a Black Vulture damage on their roof or their boat seats or things like that. We are not able to help them out with permits, but we can direct them to Fish and Wildlife for further assistance. But ours is mostly all around livestock. So we've issued those to sheep producers, goat producers, cattle producers. We see normally an influx around spring and fall calving, those time frames, but we'd be happy to help you in our office get you a permit. And if you're having problems with a roost or you have a real major problem, we can also direct you with a regional field representative of Kentucky Fish and Wildlife to help you with that. But we've been doing that for over 5 years now, and Joe Kane worked on that for a long time before he retired, and then I took over that. So I'm your main point of contact for that. So be happy to help any producers that are having issues with Black Vultures.
You know, and a really quick note for folks to understand, you don't have to have Kentucky Farm Bureau insurance to be a member of Kentucky Farm Bureau and take advantage of the benefits
Good point.
That that they provide. And, you know, I think, you know, when we say Kentucky Farm Bureau, we all think about the insurance, but it's not all about the insurance. And you can be a member without having their insurance, for sure, and then take advantage of those member benefits.
Yes. That's right. We could talk a whole hour about member benefits in Kentucky Farm Bureau.
When we talk about agriculture and Farm Bureau, the two go hand in hand. Farm Bureau's out there working every day on behalf of farmers. Why not support them and be a member as well?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things we always try to do towards the end of this show is wrap things up with a timely tip. David and Vicki, on their way up here today, we're putting together some of these notes because we were all enjoying the I-65 traffic. But the thing that they come up with today for a timely tip for your show, Fran, was to support your local farmers markets. With you being the coordinator for those certified farm markets, why don't you just add just a little bit in what farmers markets do for our communities?
Well, I think one of the good points to make there with talking about the farmers market and the on-farm markets is the difference. So the farmers market is whether, you know, like in Vicki's home county, she has the Webster County Farm Market where all the farmers come together and sell in one spot. Our farm markets that we work with, Kentucky Farm Bureau, are you're coming directly to the farm. So in Vicki's areas might be Reed's Orchard, or down your way could be Jackson's Orchard or Hinton's or Haney's Apple Dale Farm, you know, those specific things. So, but supporting your local farmer is key in this, all of this discussion, whether you're buying fresh produce or your meat for your family gathering at the holidays. Support your local farmer, get to know your farmers, get to know how food is produced in Kentucky, and support those local folks in the community, not just your grocery store down the road.
Absolutely. Well, we want to appreciate you being with us today. We want to thank Fran for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.